You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Development here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you to today's lunchtime talk. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Ryan Avant to this lunchtime talk. Ryan is the author of The Wealth of Humans and is the economics correspondent for The Economist. His work has appeared in publications including The New York Times, The Washington Post and The Guardian. Previously, he worked as an economic consultant and an industry analyst in the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. So this is a subject very close to his heart. And he was in the principal fact-finding agency for the US government in the broad field of labor. He joins us today to talk about the future of work and give us an insight into a working world we're rapidly approaching. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ryan Avant.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. So I think before launching into a discussion of the future of work, it might be useful to talk about the past of work, and in particular to reflect on the Luddites for just a moment. Now, the Luddites, as I'm sure you're all aware, were groups of craft workers in the early 19th century who were worried about the effect of technology and what it would do to their employability and their ability to survive, in fact. New technologies were coming along at the time, such as the spinning frame and powered looms, which allowed factory owners to use less skilled labor to produce much more cloth and things of that nature, in a way that made the old craft producers who worked out of their cottage much less competitive. And their response to this was essentially to run riot, to pick up sledgehammers and to attack the factories and, in some cases, the factory owners. And we generally look back today on this this behavior with ridicule, and Luddite is a very nasty thing to call someone. We ridicule this idea, this strategy, for a few reasons. One is that we now see technology as being kind of an irresistible force that could never be halted. Another is that this irresistible force has quite clearly, over the last two centuries, made us all much better off and allowed us to live longer, happier, fuller lives. But there's also a strain of criticism of Luddites that says that they were actually wrong on their own terms, that when we think about what technology does, it eliminates jobs, yes, but it inevitably creates new ones and often better ones, and that if they had just sort of played along, things would have been great for them. And I think, in fact, this is a little unfair to the Luddites. Not only did they not have the hindsight that we have two centuries later, but they also had a point, I think. When you look back at the history of the Industrial Revolution, for the first 100 years or so, living standards didn't really grow much at all. Even after they did, the workers who were enjoying wage increases lived in horribly crowded, filthy cities where they died almost as fast as they migrated in. And the gains from growth continue to be concentrated in the hands of factory owners and landowners for quite a long period of time. And it really wasn't until the 50s and 60s, after the Second World War, that the gains from growth were quite broadly shared and workers could feel good about their position in the economy. And so if you were to go back to one of these sledgehammer-wielding gentlemen and say, your great-great-grandchildren are going to have quite a nice life, but probably things aren't going to be so good for you. You will never earn this kind of wage again, and you quite possibly will die of cholera. They might say, well, I don't accept that trade-off. So I think we need to be conscious when we think about the effects of technology, that it's not a smooth process, that it's contingent, and that it's often quite difficult for workers for long periods of time. Now, the impetus for the book is a number of trends that we see across the global economy that suggests that things aren't working like they ought to, particularly where work is concerned. We saw productivity fall in the 1970s, and since then it has remained quite disappointing by historical standards, barring a short burst of growth in the 1990s. Wage growth has been disappointing across many rich countries, especially since 2000. Quite a lot of workers, especially in the bottom half of the spectrum, haven't enjoyed much of a raise at all since then. The share of national income across countries that goes to workers rather than owners of factories and owners of land has fallen. And then within the wage spectrum, there's been huge growth in inequality, especially in Anglo economies like Britain and America, as the 1% have enjoyed kind of an outsized share of the gains from growth. And I think that these trends that we see on the economic side are reflected in worrying developments in some of our societies and in our politics, in terms of communities that have been left behind, with populations that feel isolated, and in which we see disturbing trends such as growth in the rate of suicides or drug addiction. There is an increasing mistrust of elite institutions and of the globalization that these elites have kind of supported. And there is a willingness to engage in nativism or in racism, and what's really disconcerting is that we see a growing number of politicians that are anxious and have no compunction about harnessing these resentments and frustrations toward nasty political ends. And so it's not a surprise, I think, that we see some individuals like Trump or like Nigel Farage, and perhaps we should expect more of it. Here's the illustration that goes with that. So can we come up with an explanation for all of these different trends that we see? Well, I think we can. I think that the root of the problem is the digital revolution, the new technology that we see all around us. And there's quite a bit of debate about whether technology is in fact changing rapidly enough to cause this kind of problem. There are economists out there, such as Robert Gordon at Northwestern University, who looks around and says the problem with our society is not that things are changing too quickly, but too slowly. That if you look back at the Industrial Revolution, what the Luddites were upset about, you saw really fundamentally powerful changes in technology, the development of steam engine, electricity, and eventually the automobile and the airplane, that, first of all, led to a huge surge in measured productivity growth, but which also just completely changed the world around us. We went from a pre-industrial world of villages and farms to one that looked utterly different. And that if you look by comparison with the world today, it really isn't changing quite as much. And it's if you combine the sort of stasis we have in our lives with low productivity statistics, that suggests technology is not growing very much. And maybe we won't ever discover revolutionary technologies like that again. But there's a different point of view that is sort of embraced by, for instance, Eric Brynjolfsson or Andrew McAfee, people like this, who argue that in fact the digital revolution is kind of quietly but powerfully improving in its capacity to do things. That we see the development of machine intelligence and the use of big data, and the upshot of this improvement in technology is that things that we thought even a few years ago would take generations to occur are now happening before our eyes. So back in the 2000s, driverless vehicles seemed like something that would take much powerful computers, much more powerful computers than we could expect in our lifetimes to unfold, and now they're on city streets. And we have machine intelligences that can recognize speech and translate it, that can write news stories, as I opened the book describing. And I come down squarely on the side of the optimist or the accelerationist, that technology is improving quite rapidly. But how do we square this with the dismal conditions for workers? That's the key question, I think. And I think there are two big forces that help reconcile these two stories of dismal conditions for workers and rapidly accelerating technological change. And they both relate to the title of the book. The first is that there is increasingly a wealth of humans, or an abundance of labor, a glut of workers, that is the result of improving technology. And technology is contributing to this glut in a few different ways. In some cases, it's leading to automation, displacing factory workers and people in offices and such. In others, it is making highly skilled workers much more productive and allowing them to do things that used to take many more people to do. And then it's also allowed us to supercharge globalization. It's allowed companies like Apple to locate factories all over the world, track production in real time, and because they're able to do that, trade has grown very rapidly over the last 15 years, and hundreds of millions of low-wage workers in China and India have been able to join the labor force. The sort of outcome of all this is that we suddenly have a massive pool of labor that's available to companies to hire. And that massive pool is creating significant problems. Now, there were some similar trends like this in the Industrial Revolution, but we had different and positive mechanisms available to us to try to mitigate the sort of the worst effects of this glut. We could educate them, for instance. In the early 19th century, most people couldn't read or write, had no real scientific background. So we could take those workers, teach them to read and write, and suddenly they were able to take much more productive jobs paying higher wages than they could do in their small town or on the farm. Similarly, we could move them to massively growing cities where the factories were located, and in that way allow them to take advantage of the new opportunities that the Industrial Revolution was creating. Now, we don't really have the ability to do those things to quite the same extent. In the rich world, about 90% of people complete secondary degree. Nearly 50% of people complete a university degree. And it's much harder to substantially boost educational attainment. It's much harder to say to someone who's just, you know, scraped through their bachelor's degree program that, you know, now you have to go get a graduate degree in computer engineering if you want a good job. And in the same way, it's difficult to say to someone who's just lost a factory job, if you want a good living, you have to go retrain as a plumber. But by the way, you also have to move to London and in the process pay six times what you're paying now in rent. So we don't have these easy adjustment mechanisms like we did in the past. And the result is that the pressure of the abundance of labor has been felt in wages. Wages have been very low as workers have competed with each other to try to find new positions. And then the kind of a counterintuitive or surprising outcome of this is that companies who suddenly find themselves faced with this ocean of people willing to work at low wages don't feel compelled to invest in new labor-saving technologies. If you manage a warehouse and you have a long, unlimited-seeming queue of low-wage workers, you don't have to invest in the technologies that would automate the processes within the warehouse and would boost productivity. If you are running a shop, you can use low-wage workers to man the tills rather than robots. And so the ironic effect of the digital revolution is low levels of productivity, low investment in capital, and lots of people working in disappointing low-wage jobs. So that's one of the forces that I think is at work. Another is also something that can be summed up in the term the wealth of humans, and that is the rise of what I call social capital. Now, social capital has been used in a lot of different contexts by different people and can mean very different things. I use it to mean something very specific, which is patterns of behavior that only apply within particular contexts. So it's culture that's context-dependent. And that sounds sort of very vague and woolly, so let's see if we can make it more solid. If you think about what firms do today, the most profitable and valuable firms in the world are mostly engaged in knowledge creation or information processing, right? So if you have Apple, Apple's a manufacturer. It makes physical goods that sit on shelves that people can reach out and touch. But its profitability has nothing to do with its control of the machines that make these things. It doesn't handle that at all. It outsources it to others. Its profitability is entirely about the people who work within Apple, who come up with the ideas for products, who go out and understand what technology can be made to do and how to do it, and then who are able to manage these enormously complex supply chains. Doing all that requires an office space, a culture that can manage massive amounts of information and somehow use it to make good decisions. And Apple has a very profitable, a very valuable culture, a lot of social capital within it that sort of lets people know who they can approach when they have a good idea, when it's a good time to kind of to try to tweak a process in the way that they produce things. All the little things that we sort of learn when we're on the job, don't really think about much, but that shape the way that we do things, that's social capital. That affects how productive companies are. Now, why do I think this is important? Well, if you look back at the valuation of companies in the 1970s, of big S&P 500 companies, about 80% of their value was physical stuff you could measure. It was the machines they owned, the buildings they owned, the payroll that they paid to their workers. And 20% was dark matter. It was the residual that we didn't quite know what it was. That ratio is now flipped. 20% of the value of companies is the physical stuff that we can tot up on the balance sheet. And the rest, about 80%, is this dark matter. And I believe that this dark matter is basically the culture of these organizations that allows them to figure out what can be done with these fabulous new technologies and which allows them to be very profitable. And it's not just tech firms that have this. In the book, I describe how this works within The Economist, that we have all these sort of unwritten rules that we sort of learn to abide by, and at the end of each week, somehow those rules amount to an issue of the newspaper that we sell to people. And that's social capital. But this importance of social capital has a lot of interesting side effects that I think are not immediately obvious. One is that it reduces the bargaining power that workers have. So if the value that you create, that you collect in your paycheck, is mostly to do with the knowledge you got in school or in a previous job, that's human capital, right? Those are skills that you can use in lots of different settings. And you can then go to your boss, if you're unhappy with what you're earning, and say, look, if you don't give me a raise, if you don't let me have a larger share of the profits, I'm going to take those valuable skills and I'm going to go elsewhere. And so then you're able to often bargain for a higher level of pay. When human capital is just one component of this process, and social capital, the culture of the company, is more important, you suddenly lack that bargaining power. You then go to the boss and say, look, I'm contributing value. If you don't give me a raise, I'm going to go elsewhere. And he'll say, well, actually, that value is really about the way we all interact together. And if you go elsewhere, I can find another computer engineer who's highly motivated to learn our culture and thrive within it. So I'm sorry. I'll see you later. And so the bargaining power that we have within companies shifts dramatically. Now, importantly, this social capital stuff doesn't just matter within the firm context. We also see it as being crucially important within cities. So a city like London has seen its economic role just explode over the last generation. Part of that is because it is a place where firms with high levels of social capital congregate, but there is also a culture within London itself, a way of doing things that's different from other cities, that allows people to be uniquely successful here. And we see something similar in Silicon Valley, something similar in New York. These are places that encourage the transmission and processing of information and the creation of new ideas. And then we also see this at the national level. There are patterns of behavior that everyone kind of gets within rich countries that are different from what is the norm in poor countries, and that make it difficult for poor countries to grow rich. And if you take someone who lives in a poor country and you allow them to migrate to a rich country, they're able to learn those patterns of behavior and thereby succeed. But if we try to import rich country social capital to poor countries, it's much more difficult to make that work because everyone has to sort of learn the social capital, learn the culture, and then suddenly decide all at once to flip. Now, if you combine the abundance of labor with the importance of social capital, you find yourself in a very difficult place where belonging within these particular value generating communities is hugely important. The way to make someone rich is to allow them to move from a low productivity company to a high productivity company, or to move from a small city that's not very rich to a place like London, or to move from a poor country to a rich country. But because there is an abundance of labor, a glut of people waiting to try to get into these places that generate a lot of value, there's inevitably a desire within these rich places to keep others out. And so you have this conflict between the need to move people to places where they can be successful and where they can thrive and be rich, and the desire of those within them to keep them out. And so in London, you have people who are enjoying this local culture and who then fight against low-income housing in their neighborhood or new buildings that would allow others to move in and therefore exclude others so that they can protect the value that they're able to capture. And then, of course, at the national level, you see something similar. You see people who are reluctant to share the gains that they have with others. Now, can we talk about solutions? There are things that we can think about that have worked in the past and that may work again in the future to try to defuse these conflicts that we see. One is to try to make the workers better. And in the past, as I mentioned before, involved things like educating them, moving them to new cities. In the future, it may involve things like combining workers with new forms of technology in potentially weird-looking ways, such as exoskeletons. But the sort of mishmash of workers and technology is unproven, and I suspect it's going to be the case that technology is most complementary with people who already have high levels of skills. And there's certainly room to do more to educate workers, to help them develop the skills they need, and to move them to places where they could be successful by investing in housing and infrastructure and things of that nature. But I think reasonably we can't expect those mechanisms to work as they did in the past. That means that much more of the solution is going to have to come from redistribution. Redistribution can take many different forms. It can take the form of public services that are provided directly to people, free childcare or higher education. It can take the form of social ownership of the means of production, that everyone gets a share of the companies that own the robots and then lives off the dividends. Or it can mean something like a universal basic income, where because work can't be counted upon to provide people with the purchasing power they need, we simply pay them an income that allows them to live and go about their business. There are a few problems with this, though. One is that you have to, that these things don't fall out of the sky like manna from heaven. They have to be brought into existence by concerted political action. And history suggests that it takes quite a long time to develop the consensus about what kinds of policies are needed and the political groups that are willing to fight for these things and that can demand that they happen. But there's also social obstacles to this sort of redistribution. And one is that some people who stand to benefit from it may nonetheless reject it because they don't want to live in a world where work is not playing the role that it plays now. If you think about a basic income, it solves the problem of putting food on people's table, which is a critical problem, don't get me wrong. But it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't fill the other roles that work plays in people's lives, such as providing structure, providing meaning, and a sense of control over one's life. And then importantly, it doesn't fill the role that work plays, which we don't always appreciate, I think. That is, it allows people to earn a social currency. And what I mean by that is when you work, people observe that you work and see that you're contributing to society in some way. You're not just sitting around. And then that entitles you to pull out of the social safety net. That's how the social contract is sort of agreed and seen as fair by everyone. People pay in, people take out. If we no longer have work playing that role, we need some other mechanism to decide who is entitled, who is allowed to participate in the redistributive schemes. Now, it's possible we'll invent something new, like a scheme of volunteerism or community service, something that would sort of take the place of work. But it may also be that what we end up doing is something more pernicious, which is say, we're going to redistribute, but only to the people who look like us, and only to the people who are sort of within our tribe. And so my concern is that we will draw the lines of community ever more tightly and exclude more and more people. And then solution three, that's what I was just getting at, is that we would pull up the ladder. And I think that's the sort of nastiest solution, the one that leads to the most conflict. To close, I think the lesson from history that I would try to make in this book is that, to return to the Luddites, it is not the case that everything works itself out magically. It's not the case that technology changes things and then suddenly and magically provides all the solutions, the jobs that people need in the places that they want in a way that they're happy with. Instead, there's a long, long process of a social negotiation and in which we find the levers of power that can be pulled to try to create better solutions. And unfortunately, politics is very difficult. This process takes a very long time and it requires new ideas, new ways of thinking, and it requires new institutions. And those don't arise overnight, they arise over the course of decades or generations. So I'm sort of long-term positive about our ability to live in a great technological world with the digital technology we have available to us, but short-run pessimistic about how we're going to arrive there. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Long-term pessimistic, or long-term optimistic, but short-term pessimistic, which
That's
I think
right.
is probably how you would describe the Luddites when you said you're going to die of cholera, but your grandchildren will be very happy. this won't be a smooth process. And I'm interested in first starting out with a couple of questions around this process of change and transformation, because it can't be a planned process. Mm-hmm. But there are some ideas about redistribution that you've come up with. And we at the RSA have been looking at the concept of universal basic income as well, and how this might transform some of these issues about shifting and changing of society. But I think we need to pause on that, something that you sort of referred to there about the political rhetoric of productivity and hard working being really baked into how we talk about what is good. Mm-hmm. And how we shift to freeing up leisure time to something that might be more like a 15-hour week, which I think we've imagined for now, and I certainly don't work a 15-hour week. So how do we get there? What are these political conditions that you talk about that will take us to that place where, say, universal basic income is a method that we are ready to adopt?
Well, I think there's really two issues that have to be resolved before we can get to this 15-hour week world that we'd all like to see. One is the sort of logistical side of things, which is that we need coalitions of political interests that think this is a good idea, that are willing to fight for it, and that come up with a solution that is economically feasible. It's quite a big undertaking to pay a basic income to everyone in a society. You have to tax someone to do that. And so figuring out all the nuts and bolts is going to be quite complicated. But it may not be as complicated as the social side of things. And I think there are, on the one hand, you have workers, most of us fall into that category, who actually are probably have a trepidation about the idea of a workless world. Perhaps 15 hours a week would be okay. That would still leave quite a lot of time unused, and that would, I think, a lot of people would find that daunting. I think sometimes if you talk to retirees, they are miss not just the structure but the sense of mission that comes along with work, and so not having that would be a big issue. But then there's also the sense that we don't trust each other, I think, necessarily to not work. And so we need ways to think about how we're going to organize society so that we all feel okay allowing people not to work long hours. And what that means, I think, is the development of institutions that nudge people in the right direction, that create norms about how you should spend your time. Not that we force people to do things. We don't want make work, but that say, with the time that you have, these are good things to do, and you will be socially rewarded if you do them.
Mm. So that you avoid the issue of the shirker, that we are still being productive, but maybe for more of a civic purpose in that
absolutely.
Sort of way. I think that there's something to look at there about, you know, how do you maintain your social purpose or your physical activity. But there's some interesting things where you talk about what machine learning or you described yourself as the kind of technology optimist. But this quiet digital revolution of how machine intelligence actually kind of hollows out, it's already started to hollow out some clerical, secretarial, editorial work. You talk in your book about the Quake bot that wrote a not very interesting article, but, you know, was a journalist of sorts. You know, what happens when the cognitive elements of work, you know, of moderately skilled work, but then actually more higher skilled work, are taken out about our purpose as humans? You know, we still need to think. How will we then deploy that thinking time, not just our physical occupation, i.e. go and volunteer in here, but how do we maintain our sentient society? Sorry, it's rather a big question.
No, it is a big question. It's a good question. One of the sort of things that technology does is it dumbs down positions so that it can better automate them. And this is true if you think about something like Uber, where we take all the kind of human element out of it and they follow the GPS and everything is done on the app. And that means that all that's left is the actual navigation of the car. And once the cars can do that, the person is out of the equation. And something similar happened in the factory revolution. I think there is an optimistic view which says that we enjoy these cognitive sorts of work, but we engage in those rather than other sorts of cognitive activities because we have to put food on the table. And that if freed by technology from these sorts of positions, we might instead engage and spend more time writing poetry or coming up with any other, you know, other artistic pursuits. And there's a vision, I think, that Robert and Edward Skidelsky actually laid out a few years ago in a book called How Much Is Enough, in which society becomes sort of an idyllic place filled with artisans and artists and craftsmen. I think the people who are self-motivated to find those outlets will do so. And I think the thing that ends up being tricky for society are those that aren't, that would rather not work. There's a little epigraph John Maynard Keynes's 1930 piece on this 15-hour work week, where it's an apocryphal quote from a charwoman, which says, don't shed any tears, don't weep for me never, for I'm going to do nothing forever and ever. It's on her tombstone. And she's just happy she doesn't have to work anymore. And there would be quite a lot of people who fall into that category as well. And I think that's the tension between those who are motivated to go out and stay active mentally and cognitively, and those that aren't, will be a difficult one to manage. Mm.
No, absolutely. And also the issue around the human contact. There is a question of, you know, we are on the precipice, I guess, of machine intelligence being able to take on the role of the doctor or the lawyer or the lecturer. And where is the human value? You know, your book is called The Wealth of Humans. It's interesting, you know, where is the relational in that? You know, where's this role of the relationship?
Yeah, well, it's interesting to think about how these changes play out differently in sort of the world of the 1% compared to kind of those who are more struggling to get by. Among the sort of better-off people and better-off neighborhoods in London, there is an interest in maintaining these sorts of personal services and in having a personal shopper and in making sure that someone, is watching your children that you trust and are happy to talk with. And there's also a sense of community. You continue to talk with others and engage not on topics that are work-related or a personal interest. And it's almost as though this kind of world of human interaction is becoming a luxury good. And I think we'll probably continue to see that as budgets are stretched at the bottom half of the workforce, that they won't have the time to engage. They'll find themselves forced to use what technology is available to make things cheap and easy. And so I worry there will be a division within society where only part of humanity is able to appreciate this particular kind of human wealth.
The last question is to actually look into that issue around exclusivity. A commission that we're running at the moment at the RSA is around inclusive growth and how you do think about the benefits of economic growth and how they can be distributed more widely through society. You paint a pretty bleak picture of the left behind there, really. You know, both those who are cognitively motivated but also financially have more capital and social capital. You know, how do we start to bridge those divides in light of the things that are going to happen?
I think it's going to be difficult, and I suppose the book ends on this note, sort of pondering this question, and I think it ends up boiling down to a change in philosophy and sort of the way we think about each other. That there's Adam Smith, in addition to The Wealth of Nations, wrote this book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, that basically said markets aren't the only powerful thing that can affect behavior, so is human empathy. And so we have to change the sets of people with whom we feel empathy. And there's a reluctance to do that. People want to be around those who are like them. If you're rich, you want to be around other people who are rich and posh and all that. And there has to be an evolution in the way we think about our fellow humans. And that, you know, that's not something you can just conjure up. But it can be changed. And I think we did see changes like that in the way people thought about each other that occurred in the Industrial Revolution, and perhaps it can happen again.
I think there's the concept of friendly friction rather than a frictionless society that the Digital Revolution promises us,
nice
friendly friction.
Okay,
so I think we'll take one question at a time.
Sure.
So if we start with the gentleman in the front row.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was absolutely fantastic. And I've been following you for and what you've been writing for years, and for
no pressure.
But for people that doesn't know that, you know, Ryan is one of the foremost in the world, I would say, you know, authorities on everything in economics. So, you know, continue.
It's a lot.
Continue.
Thank you. I want to keep
don't
this
ruin it. Don't ruin it by answering this question.
Okay.
One of the things that I really raised my head was when you say, you know, one of the solutions to this that we don't want is pulling up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that to avoid this outcome, we need to create also, as you say, you know, a purpose for people. And if you look back through our history, it seems like when these pulling up of the ladder or, you know, other fascist tendencies like, you know, Trump, Brexit, Marie Le Pen, etc., happening, is when we have unused capacity. And you mentioned that specifically in terms of unused labor. And so my question to you, and I know you have a lot to say about this, is what can macro stabilization policy play as a role in this?
It's a great question. Those who do follow my writing closely know that I have a bit of an obsession with this topic, with macro stabilization, with the prevention of recession and with avoiding kind of long periods of underemployment. And there's actually a bit of this in the book. I'm not sure everyone will find it the most interesting chapter, but it's one that I felt I had to include. But the upshot is that the abundance of labor makes it difficult for us to avoid recessions and to enjoy the kind of strong recoveries that we were accustomed to seeing sort of back before the 90s or the 80s. But at the same time, it also makes it more important than ever that we make sure that there's full employment, that labor markets are tight, that firms feel as pressured as they can be to give raises to people. And so I think we're seeing a revolution in economic thinking now where we're starting to realize the old tools aren't going to work and that we may have to go back to more fiscal policy, to using public money to build infrastructure or to write checks to people, perhaps backed by monetary policy. And there's this idea of helicopter money, which is kind of the macro stabilization version of a basic income, where a recession is when people aren't spending enough. And one thing to do then is to give them more money. And we can give them more money by printing it. And that seems totally crazy and backwards, but it sort of is a logical chain that actually seems sensible to me. So I think I'm hopeful that economists will continue to evolve in their thinking and primarily that we will come to prioritize full employment as we used to, rather than kind of our obsessions with other things like high inflation.
Okay, so
am I still one of your favorite economists, or have I blown it?
Okay, so
we can talk.
You're still there.
Thanks very much. I thought that was really, really interesting. A majority of my research has been into 1950s and 1960s in America and the labor movement and how they responded to automation. And I think there are striking parallels that can be drawn between the conversation that you two just had about the 15-hour week and what American labor figures were talking about in the 1950s and 60s. But it strikes me that what you've described is kind of the death knell of organized labor, insofar as social capital now means more than human capital. And if you remove the force of labor, you still have that social capital that means a lot, combined with the excess labor. And this kind of points to the decline of organized labor in the last 30 years in the United States. So my overriding question is, who is going to be the body that acts as the bulwark, is that a word? Yeah. Against rapid automation, rapid modernization. If the labor unions aren't going to be able to do it, who is going to do that?
Who are the new Luddites?
Who are the new Luddites? Well, I don't know that we'd want powerful labor to lean against the deployment of these technologies, rather to make sure that the gains are shared as broadly as possible. But you're right that labor unions were critical to this process. Societies didn't just sort of decide to give people without property the right to vote or to legalize trade unions or to create welfare states that were quite generous to workers. It was basically forced upon them. Labor unions demanded it, and they were able to do so because they had particular sorts of bargaining power. It's not obvious where the parallel is now. And I think we can imagine a world where technology allows there to be more coordination between disaffected people kind of all over the world, maybe even gives them the way, it's kind of frightening to think about, but perhaps through hacking and things of that nature, to force people to the table when they don't want to come. But I'm not sure that would work. I'm not sure that it would work in the same way it did before. But I think that is the place that we need, that we're missing a critical piece, that for workers to be to get a bigger share of the pie, they need to be able to demand it. And right now they're not able to.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. It was fantastic. Two comments and a question. I mean, the comment is, I think more and more what one's hearing in analyses like yours is this notion of we are in position one. We can imagine position three, but how on earth do we go through position two without everything fragmenting and falling apart? And I think that's a question that we need really to focus very, very hard on, because actually it's not difficult to imagine what position three looks like, and it could be a great world, but it's extremely difficult to see how on earth we get there. And that's a lot to do with the weakness of our institutions, I think. Part of this, I think, is economics is part of this, which is, I think, we're finally seeing the kind of decay of kind of neoclassical, neoliberal assumptions. It's, you know, we have a conservative government now, which is kind of moving away from those kind of nostrums and sort of recognise the importance of state intervention in certain areas, for example. But again, you know, something's finally going, but it's not clear at all what follows it. And in relation to that, my question is, when it comes to this issue of redistribution, isn't part of the issue that we have to redistribute from private to social wealth, in the sense that, you know, there are 3 million jobs we could create tomorrow that would make everybody very happy. We could halve class sizes. We could massively increase the quality of care that older, frail people are getting. We could have youth services. We could have more arts provision. We could have more police officers. And these things we know would make people happy, generally speaking. They have to be run effectively. So is part of what we've got to do to say that we have simply got to use our wealth more in relation to social, shared social functions, and less in relation to private consumption?
It's a very good question. I think you make a very good point, and that is probably bound to be part of the response over the next couple of decades. I think we eventually run into trouble, though, in the sense that if technology continues to improve, it may be the case that, for instance, a high school teacher is not as good, not as effective at instructing students as a really clever, attentive, interactive machine intelligence. That seems crazy to us right now, but it could happen. And it's not just that they would be as good or better, but it would, once it's created, it's super cheap and can be deployed all over the world for next to nothing. And so the economics strongly push us toward replacing human labor, even in these fields with technology. And then we find ourselves forced to say, is it more important to protect the jobs, even if they could be automated, even if that means that these things are more expensive than they should be, and actually these teachers could be doing something else with their time? Or is it more important to use the technology to make society as productive as it possibly can be, and then figure out what we can do with our free time? And
isn't it heartening in that regard that so far the evidence seems to suggest that there is something about learning from another human being that computers can't replicate? And also that when people are treated by doctors and nurses, the thing they say that matters most is not actually the efficacy of the treatment, it's the empathy and compassion. So isn't there something a little bit heartening about the inability of computers to replace some of the things that it does seem we care about most in relation to those kind of activities? Sorry to...
No, that's okay. No, you're right. I mean, the human touch is important. I'm not very comfortable with this kind of future either. It gives me the willies. But when you look at what Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are able to do, not entrepreneurs, but innovators are able to do to elicit and sort of play with human emotions within video games or virtual reality, it's quite striking. And I think that within 20 years, we will see a lot of these human skills in the same way that we saw kind of the dexterous work that craft workers did 200 years ago, which seemed like people wanted the human touch then, but as it turned out, machines ended up just being much better at it. Now that doesn't mean we won't find human interaction and touch in other parts of life. It just might not be in the marketplace, and so we just have to come up with what those other things are going to be.
Hi, Chris Minter. I work for the National Career Service in London. It's quite daunting to ask questions straight after Matthias. This is going to be quite dumb. I provide information for skilled and careers advisors about the world of work and the future of work. And as you can imagine, we weigh up a lot about whether the future's bright, whether the future's awful. And we tend to positively go with the bright stuff, but we don't want to get too patronising because young people see through that. So what do you think we should be telling our young people, and what more should we be doing at schools and colleges to prepare them for this option two, I think we called it, which was quite worrying. And please don't tell me the option is we've got to tell them they're going to get cholera.
Hopefully not. No, I think, you know, the sort of world where most of us are not working is still quite a long way away. The world where sort of 20 to 30% of people really struggle to find a productive work is almost here and will continue to be a problem. So it's a lot of people will still be able to find good opportunities to work. I think the skill mix that they're able to choose is important. I mean, if you are a computer whiz and can go get a PhD in computer engineering, that would be a good thing to do. I don't think we'll need those skills. I think for others, it's worth emphasizing that in addition to the technical skills, it's good to be able to work well with others. That conscientiousness and listening to others is important because it's these organizations and that have these cultures that generate so much of the value in society. But then also we have to recognize that the world is going to continue to change. And so being able to teach yourself new things, to learn how to learn, is going to be really important. I think programs that emphasize kind of rote learning are not going to serve our students well in the future. But be prepared to change jobs and be prepared to work closely with others.
Building a spirit of inquiry so that they can be the motivated few to use the rest of their week productively.
I think people do crave social interaction. I just wonder if you think there's some cause for optimism in what's happened in the music industry, where live experience really appears to have taken over. Just one other. Do you think there's any place in all of this for 21st century socialism?
Just a tiny little question.
So to the second one, yes. I mean, I think that's the logical endpoint of all of this, that we end up in a world where everyone sort of owns the means of production and benefits from it. I think it's getting there that's difficult. On the first bit, you make a very good point, and I think the book goes into a little bit the rise of kind of the craft or artisanal society, that there are going to be a lot of things that people will value simply because they're not done by machines, and that might mean music performances or theater or art. It might mean craft beers that aren't industrially produced or fine cuisine. There's all sorts of things that fall into that category. I think the challenge that the book flags up is that it gets back to the sort of proximity versus exclusion thing, that if you want to be very successful as a theater actor or as someone providing or playing shows and things like that, you need to be in close proximity to the people who have money. That means being within London or San Francisco or New York, places like this. And the people who are there make those places very expensive by excluding others. And so there's, again, this tension between allowing people to come into places to earn a good living, even if they're not, building the next Uber, and those who would prefer to keep their communities as exclusive as possible. And I guess the equilibrium that we find there is that there's sort of the cream of the crop in this artisanal kind of economy that lives in London and that does fairly well, but for the great bulk of workers, it's hard to earn a good living doing these sorts of things, although it still might be satisfying for them.
Hi, thanks. Very interesting. Mine's more of a practical question, which is, for most of us, one of the major reasons we work is to pay for our accommodation. How, in an environment where I'm a participant in the crazy, crazy world of London house prices, if you're trying to house yourself and your family, how does a universal basic income deal with the situation of insane housing prices? Because that's the major reason why we all work so hard.
Another very good question. I mean, I think if you're freed from the need to work and you're paid a universal basic income, your incentive then is to go live someplace where that income will go the furthest. And so you probably leave London, even though that would be sad, and you go live someplace where home prices are much lower. And the upshot of that is that you get this very sort of intense segregation between communities of people who are still working and connected to society and people who aren't, which is not very good. So I think that the housing crisis is an issue that needs to be solved regardless of whether or not we manage to adopt something like universal basic income. It's possible that we will find new technologies that allow us to do that, better communication technologies, or old-fashioned technologies like skyscrapers. But those sorts of decisions do come down to who is entitled to live there and who has the political power to block new development or new fast rail lines to places where people could access the city. And, you know, those questions are live here and now, and I wish I had an easy, you know, a magic wand I could wave to solve them, but I don't.
It plays to that point about the kind of local lives versus the global elite and how we navigate that inequality, which is a perennial question. We have come to the end of our hour, so thank you so much for the time that we've had with you, Ryan. It's been really fascinating. It's been a kind of tour through potential of either a utopian or a dystopian future, and I'm excited for both. I may die of cholera before that happens. Let's hope not. But please do join me in thanking Ryan Avant.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.